Welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of Creighton University's Department of History. Whaling and whalers have long been a staple of American literature, art, and film. Herman Melville's Moby Dick being one of the best-known examples. But what of their wives? What kind of life did they lead? Eileen Dugan explores that subject with her guest this week, Lisa Norling. After that, Alan Winkler returns to Talking History, this time commenting on the return in America to partisan politics, or, put another way, politics as usual. But first, let's take a look at an important event that occurred this week in history. On May 11, 1987, Nazi war criminal Klaus Barbie, known to the French as the Butcher of Lyon, went on trial for crimes committed over four decades earlier. Barbie stood trial in Lyon, the city in which he served as Nazi Gestapo chief, charged with committing 177 crimes against humanity. Barbie was responsible for the deportation of 7,500 French Jews and resistance partisans to concentration camps and for the execution of an estimated 4,000 others. He personally tortured and executed many of his prisoners. After the war, Barbie was seized by American authorities and employed as an underground anti-communist intelligence agent. In exchange for his services, he was protected from French prosecutors who were pursuing him and smuggled out of Germany to Bolivia by American agents. Barbie evaded capture for more than 30 years until the Bolivian government extradited him to France in 1983. 4th, 1987, Barbie was found guilty. He served 4 years of his lifetime sentence before he died of cancer in 1991. Turning to an item of historical interest in the news, some of the open fields over which Stonewall Jackson led his Confederate troops in the Battle of Chancellorsville 139 years ago will become a 373-acre themed cemetery. With the cemetery scheduled to open in July, more than 1,200 purchase contracts have already been signed, a sure sign of eagerness among Civil War buffs to have their final resting place in the hallowed ground over which the blue and the gray fought. This is Talking History.
Sail away with me, honey, put my heart in your hand. Sail away with me, honey, now, now.
Does anyone remember Ahab's wife? Lisa Norling does, in her book on the wives of New England whalers, in which she writes about the kind of lives those women led in 18th and 19th America. Norling is Eileen Dugan's guest this week on Talking History.
There has always been something particularly poignant about the image of a sailor's farewell to his wife. The one last embrace, the clasped hands as he turns towards his ship, her look of determination behind the tears, all bespeak the uncertainty of his return. This image is a staple of maritime art, movies, and news footage in time of war. But behind the image, has there actually always been the affection? And how do sea wives carry on with their lives in their husband's absence? With us today to discuss the relationship between maritime couples in early America is Dr. Lisa Norling, Associate Professor of History at the University of Minnesota. Dr. Norling is the author of Captain Ahab Had a Wife, New England Women in the Whale Fishery, 1720 through 1870. Welcome, Dr. Norling.
Hello.
What attracted you to the subject of whalers' wives in early America?
Well, it's actually been a quite long time fascination on my part that began when I was an undergraduate and I took my first women's history course, and I was sort of astounded when we got to the 19th century at the widespread emergence of new ideas for women. And people in the 19th century seemed to fervently believe, they certainly wrote about it and talked about it and embroidered it on their pillows and cushions and so forth, the ideas that women were somehow more delicate, much more physically frail, intellectually incompetent, overly emotional, tending to be hysterical, much more so than men, and therefore that they were most appropriately sort of relegated to the female sphere of family and domestic life. And I was sort of, you know, as a teenager there in college, I was really outraged at these ideas and wondered how people could really have believed them. And so I set off on a research project to discover if there were any groups of women in 19th century America who didn't believe this. And I'm from New England originally and had spent summers on the New England coast, and so I thought that if anywhere, there would be a group of women who had not sort of knuckled under to what I considered to be a really really stifling sort of cultural regime of ideals that women were supposed to aspire to and supposed to embody. And so I went to do this research, and I found lots of wonderful sources in the museums and archives and collections, library collections in New England, particularly coastal New England. And what I discovered was sort of confounded my original hypothesis that there were women who withstood these cultural ideas, these quite pervasive cultural ideas. And so I explored them in my undergraduate research paper, and then I continued to work on this. I was drawn back to it in graduate school because I found it such a rich area for research and discussion of some larger issues that historians are grappling with in the history of women.
What kinds of primary sources did you find?
Well, it's interesting because so much of history has been written primarily about men because it was mainly sort of official records that are kept, you know, government records and industry records and so forth that document the things that people think are at the time and since are important political events and so forth. That historians of women and historians of family life are usually stymied. But when I went to look for anything I could find, I found that there were, literally thousands of letters that women had written to men at sea or to the men's employers, to the ship owners, that had been preserved in collections of family papers and even in the industry records, which are saved in some of the museums and libraries and other archives in New England. And so I found a wealth of material that no one had bothered to look at because they didn't think it was important. They thought when they looked at maritime industries, at shipping, whaling, and naval history, they thought that the most important stuff is what happens at sea on the ship. And then on shore, but in the counting rooms and the people who own the ships and the people making the decisions about what ships would go where and what they would carry and so forth. And so, I discovered that collected alongside all of that more official material was really a wealth of stuff, either produced by women, their letters and their diaries, or about women, men talking about women, religious groups, churches talking about not only the men at sea but the women at home, popular literature, magazines, novels, poetry, and so forth that really talked about the women as much as the men. So I found quite a lot of material. I think one of the most sort of dramatic things I found is that when I was looking through some account books of a ship owner, I found, and these account books had been looked at by lots of other historians who were sort of looking at the economic or the labor history in the whaling industry. They had never bothered to notice that tucked into the account book were some letters from wives of men at sea asking the ship owner for financial assistance during the voyage. And these letters had been stuck in this account book by the ship owner, but no one had bothered to take them seriously or really consider them as part of the larger story or the larger history of whaling. And when I opened the account book, and one letter literally fell out onto the library table in front of me as I was doing the research. And, you know, so I found a lot of material that other historians had simply not taken into consideration or were not interested by.
What do these sources reveal about the home life of a whaler's wife in early Nantucket?
Well, they're very explicit about the home life and the kind of community life, not just home life, but really community life of the communities on shore that supported the whaling industry, the ones that launched the ships and drew the men that staffed the ships, if you want to hear, sort of manned the ships. These letters, the ones written by women to the men at sea, they're really in a distance in the great length they were could really recount sort of daily life. We did this, we went there, we saw these people, we did that. So and so is sick. So and so got married. So and so had a baby. So and so died. So they really were an attempt to fill in sort of the details of daily life and community events and what's happening with the family and neighborhood and so forth to keep the men not only knowledgeable, but really functionally a part of the neighborhood and the family life. Then the letters that the women wrote to the ship owner, financial circumstances, in some detail as part of their appeal for some assistance. Because in the whaling industry, men were paid at the end of the voyage, so they might be gone by the mid-19th century. They might be gone for 3 or 4 or 5 years at a time, and they'd be literally on the opposite side of the world. These are ships that would leave from southern New England, places like Nantucket or New Bedford, Massachusetts, or New London, Connecticut. And they would go to the Indian Ocean, the Pacific Ocean. Even later in the 19th century, they'd be up in the western Arctic Ocean. And they would be gone for years at a time. The men would not actually receive their wages that they earned until the end of the voyage, until the ship returned to New Bedford or Nantucket or New London. And so the women would have to subsist on a number of, they had a number of resources, but one of them would be, might be advances from, advances against their husband's wages or their father's wages or their brother's wages from the ship owner. And, but more often, I found, they really relied on their own efforts. They relied, some of them performed income-producing work, would actually work for wages as seamstresses, as laundresses, as school teachers, a range of activities like that, and sort of embedded and took advantage of a neighborhood sort of system of barter and exchange, where they really would be pooling their resources with other maritime families and other extended family members in order to really get by during the men's absences.
What of the level of affection between husbands and wives? If they're separated for 5 years, do you have any examples of that?
Well, the letters themselves between husbands and wives, and I not only looked at the letters from women, but I also, there are literally, you know, many, multiple hundreds, of, well, thousands really, of letters from men back home to women as well. So I was really able to look at both sides of the exchange. Unfortunately, what gets saved are, I would often have a collection of letters that was only, you know, one half of the relationship for a particular family. But in looking at the letters that were saved by hundreds of families, I was able to reconstruct sort of both halves of the relationship. I found, and it's also true that this kind of source, these are sources that almost always were saved deliberately. Somebody saved them on purpose, important. And so these tend to emphasize the relationships that were perhaps more loving or, you know, more affectionate than the ones that were not, which might, because a non-affectionate relationship might not generate the letters or the impulse to save them. But I did find one source that gave me a kind of unbiased sample. And this is such, I found this such an exciting source. It was a mailbag of dead letters, letters that were sent to sailors at sea from the area around New Bedford, Massachusetts in the 1840s and 50s, but were never received by. These letters made their way back to a small town of Westport Point, Massachusetts, which is right next to New Bedford. It's a seafaring town. And the local postmaster there just stuffed them into a bag and then hung on to them. And when after he died, his descendants just closed up his general store there, and then it wasn't until the middle of the 20th century that all of his papers and all the contents of this general store, which also functioned as the local post office, were donated to the local whaling museum, the New Bedford Whaling Museum. And so it wasn't until the 1970s that the archivist and librarian opened the mailbag and pulled out all of these, what the post office would call dead letters. And so these were not saved on purpose by people who received them. So they were saved really by accident. So in a way, they are a really wonderful, unbiased sample. And even in that group of letters, I found a lot of expressions, a lot of affection and tenderness as people were really trying to, really love letters, as people were trying, in very affectionate letters between brothers and sisters and parents and sons, as people were trying to maintain those relationships over really extremes of distance and time.
Of all the works of literature dealing with whaling, probably Moby Dick is the most famous. And you make the point in your title that Captain Ahab had a wife. Why do you think that was important that Melville give Captain Ahab a wife?
Well, it's really interesting because he did give Melville did give Captain Ahab a wife, and yet she never appears herself in the book. There are some other women who appear in the first part of the book when the story is still set in New Bedford and then on Nantucket. There's some very wonderful, eccentric characters, like the innkeeper there, Mrs. Hussey, and the ship owner's sister, Aunt Charity, who helps bustles on board this Quaker, elderly Quaker lady carrying all kinds of wonderful delicacies and things to comfort the men on their voyage, but also she's helping carry on like whaling lances and sort of the implements of death and destruction to the whales. But Melville, I think, made a point that Ahab's wife never actually appears in person. The only time we learn about him is when Ahab, for instance, and his first mate, Starbuck, are sort of talking about their wives and when they're at sea. And it seems as though Mrs. Ahab sort of symbolizes, both for Ahab himself and then for Melville's purposes in the novel, Mrs. Ahab really is described as a sweet, resigned girl. And she sort of sums up all of the softer qualities, more humane qualities of Captain Ahab. And, of course, he leaves them on shore as he goes off in his kind of monomaniacal quest, courting sort of eternity and then disaster as he goes on his very single-minded hunt for the great white whale. And I think that what that sort of suggests to me is sort of multi-layered, suggestive situation where Melville has Ahab leave his wife behind, and she's not really a flesh and blood person. She's strictly a symbol of all of sort of the more loving, more sympathetic, more nurturing, softer, more humane qualities of life that men like Ahab have to leave behind as they go off to really find themselves and sort of pursue their manly ambitions. And I think that role for women was very important in 19th century society, and that real women were kind of trying to live out this role, both as kind of symbolizing and embodying some of the most important traits in society, that really the nurturing, the loving, the emotional connection, the traits that really hold society together, that women sort of both symbolized those and embodied them and tried to live them, that in a sense that freed up men to be the kind of ruthless capitalists that, you know, kind of drove society and especially drove economic and technological development and political development forward, that there became accentuated in this 19th century a kind of gender division of cultural labor as well as actual labor. And I think that Melville is using Ahab's wife to as a symbol rather than as a real person. And that sort of conundrum raised for me, as it has for many other people. There was recently, a year or two before my book was published, a novel called Ahab's Wife, and that novelist, a literary scholar as well as a writer, uses the same starting point to sort of explore what Melville didn't talk about, which is what is life like or what is the experience of those women who are not only symbols, but actually flesh and blood women.
How did the Victorian ideal of domesticity affect the sea wives? I mean, did they follow along with it, or did they feel conflicted about it?
Well, you know, as I said before, this was sort of my starting point for this whole project, was that I was hoping to find women who were kind of tough and commonsensical and self-reliant and who hadn't bought into it. And I didn't find that at all. What I found was really that most of these women, at least certainly the ones that left the kind of letters and diaries and sources that I found, and I think really that they were representative of the vast majority, that they did sort of embrace these ideals or buy into them. They couldn't help but be affected by them because it was really, these were the dominant ideals that emerged out of both the political and economic and social developments of the 19th century, the great sort of transformations. And they were utterly pervasive and utterly sort of embedded in the way American society and culture was heading. And these women were just as affected as any other women. And that it was sort of a paradox, or sort of really ironic, that in some ways because of the particular circumstances, the unique circumstances of their lives, while their men were away for years at a time, they had to rely on these ideas about what proper marriage was supposed to be, about what a proper family life, about what proper roles and functions for women and men. They had to rely on the ideas or concepts to maintain the real relationships in family life, because they didn't have the day-to-day interaction with the real person. So in sort of a paradoxical way, it was emphasized for them. It was kind of exaggerated. These letters read like cliches almost in some ways. It's because they're trying to maintain a very close and loving relationship with a man that they haven't seen for 3 or 4 years. And they're trying to maintain a nuclear family life with both parents, and the father's not there. And so they would do things like put their father's photograph after a photography was developed in the 1840s and spread, or before then a little painted miniature of the absent man, they would hang it up or put it on the mantelpiece and take it down every night and have their children kiss their father's picture goodnight every night. And so they would do sort of many things like that that would incorporate the absent men into the daily routines of family life as a way of maintaining his presence there and maintaining a semblance of idealized family life, even when they could never really have the actuality of it.
All right. Well, thank you, Dr. Norling.
Thank you.
We have been talking with Dr. Lisa Norling, Associate Professor of History at the University of Minnesota and author of Captain Ahab Had a Wife, New England Women and the Whale Fishery, 1720 through 1870.
The island of Nantucket, off the coast of Massachusetts, was the center of the whaling industry in the United States. So for our site of the week, we chose historic Nantucket, also one of the loveliest vacation spots in America. Here to tell you all about it is Talking History's Cindy Workman.
The 48-square-mile island, located 28 miles off the coast of Cape Cod, is home to the nation's largest concentration of 18th-century buildings and miles of pristine beaches. Nantucket evolved from a small farming community to be the capital of the American whaling industry, to a popular resort community, and is a wonderful place to vacation. The Whaling Museum contains a superb collection of whaling memorabilia and features exhibits that illustrate how Nantucketers harpooned and processed whales for their oil while at sea. There is also an exhibit on South Seas exploration, and you will also find rare artifacts from the whale ship Essex, the ship rammed by the whale that inspired novel Moby Dick. The museum is housed in a former candle factory built in 1847 and acquired by the Aquarian Society in 1921.
The events of September 11th made sure that life in America, including political life, would not be the same, at least for a while. But things seem to be back on track, and in the political arena, partisan politics has reemerged. As historian Alan Winkler suggests, there's nothing new here, and it may not be all bad.
Partisan political bickering is back, but it's not necessarily a bad thing. After the respite from partisan politics in the wake of the September 11th attacks, President George W. Bush is scaling back the fight in Afghanistan and is once more on the campaign trail. He's returning to ticklish budget questions that have no easy answers as the nation struggles to extricate itself from recession. And the Republican and Democratic parties are at loggerheads once more. It's not uncommon for this nation, or any nation, to unite in the face of danger, only to fragment again when the threat has passed. The elder George Bush enjoyed unprecedented popularity ratings during the Gulf War in the early 1990s. But then the economy fell on hard times, and he had to renege on his pledge that there would be no new taxes, and lost his bid for re-election. The same pattern has held true at other times in our past. During World War I, President Woodrow Wilson was the dominant figure in the United States. He declared that this was to be the war to end all wars, a struggle to make the world safe for democracy. The treaty that ended the war contained Wilson's plan for a League of Nations. But Wilson lost his political support as the war came to an end. In the midterm elections of 1918, his Democratic Party lost control of Congress, and that defeat was an important factor in the American Senate's unwillingness to ratify the Treaty of Versailles. In World War II, Democratic President Franklin D. Roosevelt faced a coalition of Republicans and Southern Democrats who were hostile to the New Deal and effectively ended its contributions in the 1930s. While Democrats and Republicans together mobilized to support the war effort to the hilt, they squabbled over domestic issues for the duration of the struggle. In 1946, after Harry Truman had assumed the presidency following Roosevelt's death, Republicans gained control of the houses of Congress and seemed intent on following their own aims. And the same pattern was true in Great Britain, where Conservative Party leader Winston Churchill had kept his nation together during the war, only to lose a general election to the Labour Party's Clement Attlee as the struggle came to an end. I'm not worried about the resumption of partisan debate in this country. There are profoundly important issues facing us all, ranging from the tax cuts to the stimulus package to the possibility of a better health care system. The country is just as split now as it was a year ago in the contested election of 2000. With the Republicans holding a small majority in the House of Representatives and the Democrats hanging on to a razor-thin margin in the Senate, serious debate is inevitable, and the nation is equally fragmented on other issues. Today, as in recent years, the American public is split virtually down the middle on what to do about such questions as abortion. Yet political debate is a good thing. Only through serious and sometimes controversial discussion can prickly questions of public policy be resolved. It was appropriate for the nation to come together in the face of terrorist attacks. But now, as we try to resume the patterns of normal life, political debate about the serious issues is not only desirable but necessary. There is something to be said for having a little conflict between agencies, Franklin Roosevelt once said. A little rivalry is stimulating, you know. It keeps everybody going to prove that he is a better fellow than the next man. The same thing is true for political discussion. Only by such conversation can a true consensus be formed.
You've been listening to Alan Winkler, professor of history at Miami University and the author of Homefront USA, America During World War II. This is Talking History. And finally, turning to our weekly segment, Coming Attractions, we alert you to an interesting television program on World War II, soon to air on PBS. On May 22nd, on PBS, watch for Allies at War. To the outside world, President Franklin Roosevelt, British Prime Minister Winston Churchill, and French General Charles de Gaulle were allies in the fight against Hitler. But behind the appearance of unity were contentious private battles that threatened the entire war effort. This is the first documentary ever to reveal this intensely personal drama of rancor and deceit. Be sure to check your local listing for the exact showtime. And that's it for another week of Talking History. I hope you've enjoyed the show. We invite you to send us your comments or suggestions either by email at talkinghistory@creighton.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History, Creighton University, Omaha, Nebraska, 68178. Talking History is a production of Creighton University and the Organization of American Historians. Until next time, from the studios of KIOS-FM in Omaha, Nebraska, this is Brian LeBeau.